Welcome to Eucharist Podcast, where we're exploring what it looks like for a community of disciples to live all of life in reference to Christ. This is part two of a four-part series called The Urban Contemplative, given by Dr. Dennis Aucombe at our church retreat, where we looked at applying the rhythms of Benedictine spirituality to life in the city. Enjoy.
The Lord be with you.
I start my, there's different liturgies. I always start my classes that way, partly to get their attention, but also to remind them that if the Lord's not with them and with me, we've got problems. So, a couple of leftovers from last night, and also for a few of you who weren't here last night, just to kind of bring you up to speed. First of all, my wife told me, Trebekah told me last night that I didn't answer Daniel's question appropriately. So because I probably didn't understand it, about the seminary and the monastery. And just a couple of things about that. The difference, one difference between a monastery and a seminary, a huge difference, would be that a seminary is always going to be a different community every year because people are graduating and new people are coming in. And where the monastery, Sister Michaeline, one of the monks I mentioned last night who introduced me to the Benedictines, she's been a monastic for over 60 years. So her community, yes, is changed by people who've come in and died, but they've known each other, many of them, for decades. And another reason is because, and I think about this with our university too, because our university is not a church. The requirement to get into a seminary or a college or university is that you have to have money and pulse, maybe a degree from your previous institution too. Whereas a monastery, again, for the Benedictines, the requirement for the monk is basically, do you seek God? That's the question that is asked, and so that's not necessarily the requirement for a seminary, strangely enough. Yeah, so it's a good question, and I'm sorry that she said I gave you a good answer, but it just wasn't to your question. And then for those of you who weren't here last night, but also for those of you who were, I was trying to give you the right impression of these monks. So I wanted to read you one more vignette about these monks. The name of this book is A View from the Monastery. A View from the Monastery. And each of the vignettes are about 4 pages long or less.
Favorite size.
Oh, yes, they're great. You can read one a day. So this is the telephone problem. The telephone problem. This will give you a kind of a feel for the kind of community they have in reality. Answer the phone, Lum, Father Cletus says, whenever he hears it ringing. He grew up listening to Lum and Abner. Some of you are old enough to remember. Proprietors of a country general store on a popular weekly radio show in the 30s and 40s. The problem is that on weekends, the phone often isn't answered. No one is on duty, and most of the monks aren't near the phone, especially on nice days in the summertime. Some monks never answer the phone because of impaired hearing or because they don't know how to connect the caller with the person being called. Brother Felix answered our phone for 35 years, and in his later years, it became a burden for him. Sometimes he forgot to deliver messages. His hearing was going, and this accounted for the delivery of inaccurate messages. He once gave me a callback number for a startled stranger in South Carolina, a state in which I know absolutely no one. He became irritated if he couldn't locate a monk who had a phone call. Before phones were installed in our rooms and places of work, Brother Felix had to come after us. Go on the phone, he'd say. If he couldn't find the monk being called, he often expressed displeasure to the caller, who apologized for having bothered him. I answered the phone one time, and the party on the other end said, oh, thank God, I was praying the German wouldn't answer. If people called after 10 o'clock in the evening, Brother Felix instructed them to phone back in the morning. I overheard him tell a caller, I not look for him now. I'm in the bed, and I got no clothes on. Sometimes if a monk being called was not in the house at the moment, Brother Felix wouldn't inform the caller where he could be reached. Don't hang up, brother. Don't hang up, a friend of Father Stan's pleaded one time, but he did, and the man had no inkling of where to find Father Stan. Aside from personal calls to individual monks, people phone here mostly to arrange retreats or to sell us something. The day before Christmas, callers want to know at what time midnight mass begins. Some of them are surprised when we tell them midnight. One time, I took a call from a man who had obviously dialed the wrong number. And I'm going to change the language because of the children here, but isn't this Olson's Auto Parts? I repeated, this is Blue Cloud Abbey. What's that? A Catholic monastery. No! I kid you not, he said. I wonder what Brother Felix would have said to him. When I entered the monastery, the phone was seldom used for anything besides business calls. We wouldn't even have entertained the thought of dialing friends or relatives just to chat. Nowadays, the use of a telephone is no longer restricted. For a while, though, the treasurer was presenting each of us with a monthly record of our personal calls. If this was intended to him to hint that some of us were making an excessive number of calls, it must have worked. The treasurer hasn't presented us with any telephone bills in a long time. On the other hand, he may have just given up. So most, I'm getting my watch here because I don't want to belabor you too long. Most of the monks have cell phones nowadays that are owned by the monastery. So if they're going on a trip, they simply borrow one, which is typical of the Benedictine vow of poverty, which is not a Franciscan vow of dispossessing yourself of everything, but of sharing everything. When the monks enter the monastery, they either give everything that they have to the poor, or they contribute it to the monastery. And so everything is shared by all and is to be used by all. Not that they don't have their own personal possessions in their cells, but that's the flavor of it. And a couple of quotes I wanted to share with you from that related to last night. I mentioned to you that the question that the monastery forced me to ask is, what is the real world? And maybe the real world isn't the world of our mundane existence in some ways. Maybe the real world that God wants us to know is a world that's underneath the surface of our living. And in that regard, in Monk Habit, in this book, Monk Habits, I quoted a quote from John Newhouse. John Newhouse was a Lutheran who became a Catholic priest. And he wrote a wonderful book called Death on a Friday Afternoon. And this is what he says at one point. We contemplate for a time the meaning of Good Friday and then return to what is called the real world of work and shopping and commuter trains and homes. As we come out of a movie theater and shake our heads to clear our minds of another world where we live for a time in suspended disbelief, as we reorient ourselves into reality, so we leave our contemplation. We leave the church building. We close the book where for a time another reality seemed possible, believable, even real. But we tell ourselves the real world is a world elsewhere. It is the world of deadlines to be met, of appointments to be kept, of taxes to be paid, of children to be educated. From here, from this moment, at the cross, it is a distant country. Father, forgive them, for they have forgotten the way home. They have misplaced the real world. Here at the cross, is the real world. Here is the Axis Mundi. I think that's profound, and it's kind of like what I was explaining to you my first time in the monastery and then going to the mall after that. It was like coming out of a movie where you've been in another situation for a while and then having to reorient and shake my head and get it back together. And then I mentioned to you that one of the reasons I like Benedictine monks is because they not only are contemplatives, but they also are apostolic. They go into the world and do apostolic work to change the world. And in that light, there's a quote also by a man named Alistair MacIntyre, who's a Christian ethicist. And in one of his, in probably his most famous book, he says this, a crucial turning, and I think it relates to our culture right now, very much so, a crucial turning point in history occurred when men and women of goodwill turned aside from the task of shoring up the Roman Imperium and cease to identify the continuation of civility and moral community with the maintenance of that imperium. What they set themselves to achieve instead, often not recognizing fully what they were doing, was the construction of new forms of community within which the moral life could be sustained so that both morality and civility might survive the coming age of barbarism and darkness. What I was talking about last night about the church being an alternative community, just like the monastery is an alternative community. We ought to conclude that for some time now, we too have reached the turning point. What matters at this stage is the construction of local forms of community within which civility and the intellectual and moral life can be sustained through the new dark ages which are already upon us. And if the tradition of the virtues was able to survive the horrors of the last dark ages, we are not entirely without grounds for hope. This time, however, the barbarians are not waiting beyond the frontiers. They have already been governing us for quite some time. And it is our lack of consciousness of this that constitutes part of our predicament. We are waiting, not for a Godot, but for another, doubtless very different, Saint Benedict. So that's the situation I think we find ourselves in. And I just want to continue to encourage you, in light of these monastic communities, that as church communities, we also can be all these alternative communities that give the world hope, that there is another way to live that is formed by the cross of Jesus Christ. And to get into that, there's some aspects of monastic spirituality that I think are very helpful for us. And one is stability. The Benedictine monks take three vows. They take a vow of stability and then of obedience, but also of conversatio morum, and I'll talk about that in just a little bit in light of stability. But stability means that a Benedictine monk, when he enters into the house or she enters into her house, is going to promise to stay with that community for the rest of his or her life. It's not a glamorous idea. It's much like a marriage vow in that sense. And the promise of stability then is, again, to commit as if, in a sense, that's the only community that exists. Not an ideal community. Not the ideal community I want it to be, but the community that it's really going to be, of real people who are actually going to rub up against each other for decades and even cause friction and some issues they have to deal with. And it's a community then that they believe God has chosen them to be in. In other words, they're not in control of the environment that God has chosen to shape them in. It's a very unspectacular idea. It goes against the modern notion that, and I want to develop this, that contentment and fulfillment consist in constant change. In other words, if we can't find God in the situation that God has placed us in, we probably won't find God anywhere else. And so what I want to develop is this notion that I've learned from these Benedictines, that if we're tethered to the communities that God has called us to, then we can come face to face with our true selves. And it gets rid of all the superficiality and all the guile and all the confusion as we work out our salvation with each other, which is a very biblical idea. So one of the monks that in the rule of Benedict at the beginning that he detests, he calls the gyrovags. The gyrovags. It comes from words, a Latin word for meaning circle and a Greek word for wander. These are monks who wander around in circles. They go from monastery to monastery. And they never really stay in one place. Benedict's description of them is this: always on the move, they never settle down and are slaves to their own wills and gross appetites. They're always slaves to their own wills and gross appetites. And I thought, a lot of us are like modern-day gyrovags, believing that the grass is greener on the other side of the fence, until we get to the other side of the fence and find out the hue is basically the same. I mean, we have that sense, don't we? We have the sense that if we just get to this into this other relationship, or we just get into this other church, or we get into this other job, or we move into this other city, life's going to be better. But that's not usually the way it happens. I mean, unless of course it's an abusive situation or something like that, of course. But sometimes we just think that if we find that other place, it'll be okay. And That's in part because this other vowel that they take, conversatio morum, it's hard to translate, as I mentioned last night, but it's really the idea that you should be aware of the fact that your conversion takes place daily. You know, when I grew up as a Baptist, we were converted once, right? Right? And you heard the altar call, you went forward, you said the sinner's prayer, you're in, that's it, you're done. That was the idea. But what I've really learned from these Benedictine monks is that, no, conversion is a daily turning around. It's a daily quest to be more and more Christ-like, to be more and more what God has called us to be. And so this vow of stability, I think, is deeply connected to this vow of conversatio morum, conversion of life. In other words, in a sense, stability is understood in the context of, as one person put it, growth through conflict. Growth through conflict. In other words, the monastery is this community that you've promised to stay in, where you're going to face some personal battles, some spiritual battles, some community battles. And so the monks came up with this famous phrase, stay in your cell, and your cell will teach you everything. Stay in your cell, don't run away, and your cell will teach you everything. What I think oftentimes we think of, which becomes sometimes useless and dangerous and destructive, is to imagine that our enlightenment, our virtue, our growth is going to be found by seeking some sort of fresh stimulation somewhere else. But the monastic life is a refusal to accept the notion that human maturity before God is dependent on external stimuli. Here's the way one person put it, that salvation, and this is why I ended with that prayer last night, salvation affects the whole of the psyche. To try to escape boredom, sexual frustration, relentless, unsatisfied desire by searching for fresh tasks and fresh ideas is to attempt to seal off those other areas that have been frustrating from grace. Because we're running away from those. Without the humiliating, as this person put it, and wholly unspiritual experiences of cell life, the limited routine of trivial tasks, the sheer tedium and loneliness, there would be no way of confronting human nature. It is a discipline meant to destroy illusions. The monk has to come to term with who the monk is. And that's a tough one. Because if you're with the same people day after day for decades, you're going to have to come to terms with yourself. And so that's why it's not just conversion, but conversatio as well. When I was a kid in the Assembly of God Church, we had this youth group called Sky Pilots. You know, so it was kind of cool. We got the little patches and stuff. We made gliders, you know, out of balsa wood, and then we memorized verses. Verses were from the King James Version. And so one of the words used in the King James Version is "be careful of your conversation." That means. And all it meant was, as one of the colonels in Sky Pilots told me, is that conversation means your walk of life. Take care with your walk of life. And yeah, it's not just the beginning of the journey. It's the journey itself that requires constant awareness in my life. And again, the stability helps me. The stability, as I said, is commitment to a community, and it's a stability of place. So even though the monks might go on a missionary venture, like I was telling you, the Blue Cloud Abbey monks, some of them went to Guatemala to help the monastery they established there. They might stay there for maybe a year or two before they come home, but they always come home because that's their community that has shaped them and continues to shape them. And I think that, again, that's much like a family or a marriage vow or the church situation. It's like a GPS, you know, when you hit the home button and it brings you back where you're supposed to be. But it's more than that in that sense. It's remaining to stay in this place. It's really being faithful in that place. What I mean by that is, we can live with the same people. We can work with the same people for years and years and years and really not be invested in their lives. Part of stability is being attentive to those with whom we exist. It's being with them at all times, very intentional ways, with each other. And that requires something else that I learned from the Benedictines, and that's persevering in listening. I told you last night that the first words of the Benedictine rule are, listen, my son, to the wisdom of a father who loves you. And that made me think about the fact that we're not very good at listening. I'm not always very good at listening, because partly we live in a media glut, right? It's worse and worse. I was just reading an essay on the way here on the plane yesterday about the fact that young people, I don't know the age group, I didn't mention it, are on their cell phones a total of 5 hours a day. And that usually involves 85 separate times. And I see it at the school. You know, I tell my students, you know that picture of evolution of man, you know, where it looks like this? Now we're going back. Or I'll see a student walk down the highway, the hallway, and they're going like this, you know, right, you know, and I'll walk right by them and I'll say, Jesus just went by, you missed him. And it could be literal, right? I mean, Jesus sometimes going to say, you know, we're going to say, when did we see you, Jesus? Well, you know, when I was in prison, when I was naked. Oh, and when you were on your cell phone. And so there's a sense in which we need to be very attentive. And we have, 'cause we have this media glut. And part of it affects our listening. Some of the noise comes from our environment. When I took six students in North Dakota to live in a monastery for 10 days for a January class, they came back. I gave them 2 days to decompress, to come back to the college before we had class again. And I said to them, what was your first reaction when you came back to the college campus from the monastery? Because I was interested, my first reaction, going to the mall, you know. And Brent, this football player dude, said, I didn't realize how noisy the dorms were. I never knew that before. Because he had been in the relative silence, not complete silence, but relative silence of the monastery. And that reminded me of what Father Guy, one of the first monks I ever met, said to me one time. You know, Samuel was told, listen, Lord, just to say when God spoke to him, listen, Lord, for thy servant is speaking. How do I get that? Right? What is it? How's it going? Listen. Speak, Lord. Yes, for thy servant is listening. Because Father Guy said, usually we say, listen, Lord, for thy servant is speaking. So I can't hear God speaking to me because I'm always speaking. I appreciate the times of silence that we've had. You know, even at the beginning, as you led us this morning, Ryan, just to take even a few seconds just to be silent. Our lives are filled with so much noise. And even when we think it's silent, there's still noise in the environment that's going on. Planes overhead, and, you know, lights humming and things like that. But silence isn't silence for its own sake. Silence is so that we can hear other voices. Richard Foster, some of you have read his stuff, he said, simply to refrain from talking without a heart listening to God is not silence. In fact, silence is not virtuous unless it is practiced for the love of God and the love of others. Part of, I think, stability is being very attentive to those who with whom we have made commitments. And part of this has to do with the fact that the noise not only hides us from ourselves, and we'll keep talking about that a little bit too, but it can also help us keep us from hearing the needs of others. This may sound trivial to you, but the first time I did go to the monastery, and I was there for 3 days, and I had to drive back in a winter North Dakota scenario where about 3.5 hours, Father Guy, this same monk that I mentioned, at breakfast, just before I was going to leave, get my car and leave, said, "Do you have a thermos?" And, "Yeah," I said, "it's in the car." And he said, "Would you like to fill it up with coffee for your trip home?" That may sound trivial to you, but I thought, wow, he's thinking about the fact that I have a 3.5 hour drive in the North Dakota winter ahead of me, and he's concerned that I might appreciate to have a hot drink along the way. He was listening to me. And it called attention to the fact that I'm not always attentive to other people, to their agenda, because I'm pretty much listening to myself. I joked about it that if, Father Guy guessed that if it had been my wedding at Cana, I would have asked Jesus to change the water into strong black coffee. Guy had listened to me and heard my needs, my wants, even better than I had, because I probably wouldn't have even thought of it myself. So I think by learning to listen, by being intentional and being in that stability with our community, we can become more attentive to God's action around us and even to see the needs of our brothers and sisters, needs of which maybe they aren't even aware. It helps us to be aware of the reality that's going under the surface of what we thought was the real world. And we begin to be attentive to the fact that all of life is sacramental. All of life is sacramental. God meets us in the material world, but we have to be attentive to see that God in the material world. You know, see, it's kind of like the cross, right? When you read the gospel accounts of the crucifixion, if everybody had seen what was going on, then all the centurions would have said, "Surely this was the Son of God." But as far as the gospel record is, only one saw that. They all saw the same event, but one saw underneath the surface the sacrament that was happening, that it was God who was there on the cross. So I think that's a lot of what this stability and listening has us doing. And by the way, maintaining silence in the relative silence or listening makes us feel so helpless and out of control, right? One of the ways we control things is, by not having silence, right? Because we've been accustomed to managing everything. We were talking on the way here about the fact that management has become an occupation, right? In many respects, we want to manage everything so that maybe we feel comfortable in our environment and so forth. But if we're silent, we ask the question, who's going to take control? Maybe God. Maybe it's just God who's going to take control. You know, I was thinking about this. Jesus is even silent before his accusers at his trial. Right? They keep asking him, are you? And it's not until they get to the question that he wants them to ask that he opens up. He's even silent before his accuser. And I've often thought of this story of the Syrophoenician woman who comes to Jesus. And she says, "Jesus, heal my daughter. Heal my daughter." And she's a Gentile. She's a woman. She's already got 2 strikes against her in that culture. And if you read this account in one of the Gospels, it says Jesus did not answer her a word. He was silent. The disciples thought his silence meant that he didn't care. So they said, "Do you want us to send this woman away? She's bothering you, Jesus." Instead, she comes closer. And then she says, "Jesus, son of David." She actually addresses him as if she was an Israelite. And he says to her then he breaks the silence. But then listen what he says. He says, "I only came to serve Israel. And so she comes closer and she says, yes, but Lord, even the dogs get the crumbs that fall from the children's table. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the word dog there is a word we would use for a pet dog. And at that point, he says, woman, your faith is greater than I've seen of all of Israel. May it be done for you as you ask. In other words, sometimes silence is also a way of making us more attentive to God. Jesus' initial silence was a way of drawing her closer to him. I mean, if he had just said, okay, your daughter's healed, she'd have gone home, and it probably wouldn't have changed her the way it did. So I think this part of stability, that we become fully invested and more attentive, which might even involve silence and listening, becomes extremely important in our lives. And I think that's why Benedict started the rule with those words. Listen, my son, to the wisdom of a father who loves you. Unfortunately, as I mentioned, we're kind of captives of a technologically enabled, consumer-driven, efficiency-minded, instant result-oriented world, right? And that's even affected the church. So that, and we have seen these church worship services where they become entertainment, and right, and they're techno-driven, and they don't demand anything of us except just to be spectators, which is why I love the Anglican liturgy. She's a Lutheran, but if you know this woman, she's edgy. Nadia Boltz-Weber, have any of you read her stuff? Yeah. She's a real edgy Lutheran pastor with tats all up or down her arm and buff, because she does, CrossFit. Yeah, she's serious. But she was speaking to a bunch of Lutheran youth who filled up the Superdome. I didn't know there were that many Lutheran youth. And by the way, I'd encourage you at some point, go to YouTube and look up her talk to the Lutheran youth in the Superdome. Nadia Boltz-Weber. I have this, about every 3 or 4 months, I have a listserv, and I just invite a bunch of people to come and discuss a book, whether somebody else suggested it or I suggested it. And so one time you have to bring a craft brew, and I have read the book. And so you come to the house, and I provide pizza, and we have a good time discussing the book. And so one time, sometimes they're heavy books, but sometimes they're a little lighter, and so we read her book, The Accidental Saints. She has a church called the House for All Saints, I think it's called. So.
House of All Saints and Sinners?
Yeah, because she's big on sinners, yeah. Yeah, I mean, seriously, anybody's invited. Yeah, it's really wild stuff. But the reason I mention her is because she says at one point in her talk that that they had a T-shirt or a sweatshirt that referred to liturgical aerobics. And that's what I love about the Anglican liturgy. It's liturgical aerobics. We're not just spectators. This isn't just entertainment. And so I think sometimes this culture that not only doesn't encourage us to have stability, it also encourages us even to be restless, even in our worship, in the sense that I've got to be driven by this external stimulus. I've got to have some entertainment there for me. It's got to be techno-driven and so forth. Part of the problem is we've been given so many options. This is, I think, one of the reasons why we would have a difficult time with Benedictine stability. Our options have increased so much in our culture. Our choices have increased so much in our culture. One study showed that the average American supermarket carried 9,000 product choices in 1976, and now it carries nearly 49,000 product choices. I mean, just go down the cereal aisle, right? And I love Oreos, but how many ways can they make Oreos? I was astounded the other day. I went in the supermarket to get some Oreos, and now there's like 20 different choices of Oreos. You know, my classic cookie is hard to find now, because it's all different shapes. We have so many choices in life that even in that regard, stability is difficult. There was a book I read years ago by a sociologist named Alan Ehrenhalt, and he was studying three communities in the Chicago area. He did a study of them in the 1950s and then the 1980s. And the basic conclusion that he came to was that in the 1950s, they had fewer choices, but they had a greater degree of community. Right? Maybe one car, maybe. So you went to, you know, the local butcher, you went to the local stationer, you went to your parish church, you had much more community. In the 1980s, he found that because now maybe you have two cars with the family and you have not the local stationer, but you have Office Max 5 miles away, and you've got a major supermarket 3 miles away that's going to give you lots of choices and discounts and such. And now you've got all these churches, including some mega churches, that might be even a 45-minute drive away. That, you know, it's like a mall when you drive into them. He found that they had more choices, but they had less community. And so here's what he says toward the end of his book. That now most of what we do on a daily basis resembles channel surfing, marked by a numbing and seemingly endless progression from one option to the next, all without the benefit of a chart, logistical or moral. Because there are simply too many choices and no one to help us sort them out. We have nothing to insulate ourselves against the perpetual temptation to try one more choice rather than to be with what is on the screen in front of us. Again, stability. Thinking the grass is greener on the other side. One more choice. One more relationship. One more job. One more, you know, move. Doesn't always work that way. Michael Casey, who is a Cistercian monk, you know, the ones that are on Benedictines on steroids that I mentioned? He's written some wonderful books, and he put it this way. There's no one at home in us except the flickering images that we receive from outside. No one home in us except the flickering images we receive from outside. It's because we base our lives on external stimuli now, and there's not much inside. There's an Eastern Orthodox archbishop named Anthony Bloom who wrote a wonderful little book called Beginning to Pray. And I was struck by this thought experiment that he gave me. Listen, settle down in your room at a moment when you have nothing else to do and say, I am now with myself. And just sit there with yourself. After an amazingly short time, you will most likely feel bored. This teaches us one very useful thing. It gives us insight into the fact that if after 10 minutes of being alone with ourselves, we feel like that, it's no wonder that others should feel equally bored. Which, by the way, as I was thinking about this morning, reminded me of something my daughter said to us one time. When she was in high school, she was given an assignment. List some people you admire and why you admire them. And so she came home and said, Mom, I put you and Dad on the list. And Mom, here's the list. And oh, it was a great list. If you've met Trevecca, you know she has admirable qualities all the way down the list. So I said, well, Emily, I said, what did you put for Dad? Oh, I just had one. She said, when you speak, you think people want to hear what you have to say. And I said, Emily? She said, no, that's a good thing, Dad. That's a good thing. So anyway. If I can sit with myself for 10 minutes and I get bored, maybe other people are bored with me. But he goes on. He says, why is this so? It's so because we have so little to offer to our own selves as food for thought, for emotion, and for life. If you watch your life carefully, you will discover quite soon that we hardly ever live from within outwards. Instead, we respond to incitement, to excitement. In other words, we live by reflection, by reaction. We are completely empty. We do not act from within ourselves, but accept as our life a life which is actually fed in from outside. We're so used to things happening which compel us to do other things. How seldom can we live simply by means of the depth and the richness we assume that there is within ourselves. I think that's so insightful. I mean, I've asked myself, if I was held hostage somewhere, like a brother Peter that I was telling some of you about at dinner last night, who is a monk at the monastery where I'm an oblate, St. Andrew's Abbey. And we went to a one-day retreat with Brother Peter. He was held in by communist Chinese, the Chinese monk. He was held in communist China for 26 years in prison. 26 years. He gets a one-day retreat every year at St. Andrew's Abbey. And he's just a little joyful man. One hand is kind of shriveled up because he was in solitary confinement, chained for 6 months at a time. And I asked myself, if I was in that situation, would I have enough stored inside that it could sustain me? He composed 1,000 hymns while he was in prison during those years, 600 of which he has recalled from memory and written down and published. Do I have enough in me? Or have I just been so restless that I've just depended on all the stimulus from outside and responded to that? I thought about that, you know, even in light of the fact that long before, you know, computers and all of that, I was being forced to memorize verses. Now we just Google, what was that verse again? To memorize verses of the Bible and have them inside of me. The liturgy, you guys know some of this now by heart, some of you, because you've gone over it and over and over it. It's inside of you. And if you were in that situation, you would use it. We got to ask him questions, and we asked him, I think Trebek asked, did you have Eucharist at all? And he said, well, you know, they didn't give him bread and wine for Eucharist, but he said, I said it in my heart. Because he knew the Eucharist. He knew the liturgy. And it sustained him. The only thing he was given was a pagan calendar. You know, the calendar, it's based on Greek gods and Roman, right? That's what we're named after, right? March is named after Mars, and August after Augustus, and so forth. We have a church calendar, which you guys follow, where New Year's Day is the first Sunday of Advent. Woohoo! You know, celebrate. And we have other things on there that remind us of the biblical story. But he was given a calendar, and then he just filled it in with what he remembered from the church's calendar so that it would keep him on track. So that's part of the issue of stability. Can I stay in place, in a sense, and with community, with what God has, where God has placed me in such a way that I can ingest this and it becomes part of me, and I'm not just living from constant excitement, constant stimulus from outside. Part of the issue there is what's called in Greek, hupomone. It's a word we translate perseverance, hupomone. It's not a grit your teeth determination, but it's patient endurance that's motivated by a gracious disposition. It's not a grit your teeth determination. It's a patient endurance that's motivated by a gracious disposition. It actually involves this perseverance, again, remaining where God has placed you. Kathleen Norris, and I know some of you have read her stuff, and I mentioned her last night as a fellow Presbyterian at the time when we were in the Dakotas and coming to the Benedictines at the same time. And she's written several books, and one about the quotidian tasks of everyday existence. In other words, just the everyday routines. And following the schedule, you know, the day after day, same place, the workplace, same, going to the same place, being with the same people, same community, same workmates, spouse, family, whatever. That provides the specifics for hupomone, for perseverance. You persevere in the quotidian tasks of everyday life. And again, then you find God sacramentally, even in those situations. It's interesting that in the Rule of Benedict, the qualifications for the cellarer, the person who's in charge of all the material possessions in the monastery, including the pots and pans, is almost the same qualifications as for the abbot, the one who leads the monastery. And I think one of the reasons he set those qualifications for the cellarer is because the cellarer is so important, because the monks have to be aware of the fact that we have to take care of these material possessions, because We might even find God in the midst of using these. Maybe a pot or a pan that's in your kitchen would remind you of maybe some celebrations you've had in the past with a family and so forth. And they even become a sacramental presence of God, in a sense. They remind us that God is present here. And this is making me think of, I won't go into it, there's a philosophical theologian, Herbert McCabe, that I really like. And he helped me to see that even when we sit down, like at a Thanksgiving meal at the table, that turkey is no longer a turkey. It becomes something different. Like the bread and the wine become to us the body and blood of Christ, that turkey now becomes, in a sense, a more than even a symbol of those who are around our table, whether they're friends or family. And so in the same way, these quotidian tasks, these everyday tasks, can become a way that we go underneath the surface of daily life and are aware of God's presence. And now, the people that I've been assigned to be with by God, one of the monks, Father Guy again, said one time to me and to my students, being in a monastery is being with people you may not have chosen to be with if it had been up to you. I mean, in one sense, you may not even have chosen to be with this church. God may have called you here and told you to stay. The church that I was describing, the Presbyterian church that I was describing last night, that was dead. It would have been nice if we'd have, you know, could have gone to the Lutheran church down the street. It was so alive, you know. Even the Catholic church, I think, was more alive than this one, and in North Dakota. Catholics in the Dakotas, you know, are kind of cultural. But, I mean, it was very alive. And the Episcopal church, oh, that was great, great. But God had called us, we felt, to be in this Presbyterian church, to be with people that we would not have chosen to be with. And I think sometimes God does that. Every semester, when I have a new class, when I have new classes, I go over my attendance policy, but I don't tell them it's an attendance policy. I say, the reason you need to be here is because I don't know why God put you in this class. You know why, it fit your schedule. But God put you here, and something that I or some other classmate might say one day might change your life, or you might need to be here to say something that's going to change our lives. I don't know. That's stability. To be with people, to be in a community that God has called you to for reasons that you may not even be aware of yet. That's exactly what the Apostle Paul says in Ephesians chapter 4. That we grow up together into the maturity that's measured by Christ Jesus. He didn't say we grow up individually. We grow up together into the fullness of the stature that's measured by Christ. And he says we do it by speaking the truth in love to one another. And this gets us into that's why by the way, we mentioned last night, the Benedictine monastery is a school for the Lord's service. It's a place where I learn what it means to be Christ-like together with community. And when Paul says that we speak the truth in love to one another, here's what he's getting at. Get this. If I am in the same community for year in and year out, I can no longer keep the mask up. If I'm always church hopping or church shopping, I can keep the mask up. If I'm always moving into another relationship on a regular basis, that other person doesn't really get to know me as I am. And I can keep the mask up. One of the huge reasons for stability, again, is this conversion of life that's on a daily basis, where the mask finally has to slip. And because the people know me for who I am. Yeah, Trevecca and I have been married for over 43 years now. If I say to her sometimes, I didn't really mean that, she can say, yes, you did. or you really, you know, did this when you were doing that, or because she knows me. But if I'm constantly moving in and out of relationships, I won't change because I don't have to. I don't have to. Stability forces us even to face ourselves. Rowan Williams, former Archbishop of Canterbury, said, "The barriers of egoistic fantasy are broken by the sheer brute presence of other persons." The barriers of egoistic fantasy are broken by the sheer brute presence of other persons. In that sense, the monk is saying, I renounce my freedom to get up and leave at any time. And here's the way, let me just read a little bit to you about the way one monastic put it this way. "I discover, if I renounce my freedom to get up and leave at any time, I discover a freedom to explore the place where I am, to send down roots, to let something grow, to reach maturity and produce fruit from deep within me." You know, if you keep digging up a seed every day to see how it's doing, it won't grow. In other words, he argues exterior stability serves interior stability. For instance, it grows my love of God. And he says, "The practice of stability helps me to look for the loving presence and power of God everywhere and in every situation. Wherever I am right now is the place where God's mysterious design has placed me and wants me to be. I have not been thrown into this precise situation, nor did I drop here by chance, but I was placed here deliberately and lovingly for a reason that becomes clear if I look for the signs of God's will for me in these concrete circumstances. Why am I here? What mission have I here for God and for others? Confidence in the mystery of stability teaches me to experience every situation as the place where a divine, loving will permits me to be at this moment of my life." Henri Nouwen reflected one time when he was in an airport, impatiently waiting for his plane, impatiently waiting in the airport, saying, "You know, then I just had to realize I'm here. This is where God wants me right now for some reason, and I have to discover why." In other words, stability forces us to believe what we say we believe, that we believe God is guiding us providentially. That, I think, is something that's hard to learn, but we have to believe that. God is guiding us providentially, and there are situations we find ourselves in that we all get impatient about and we all don't want to be in. Again, we're not talking about abusive situations or anything like that, but we're talking about normal day-to-day situations where, here I am, God, this is where you want me to be. Why? Why am I here? Why are these people here? Why is it like this? So it's just coming to grips with God's active involvement in our lives on a day-to-day basis. Again, God meets us through the material world. God doesn't meet us in some sort of super spiritual high up here. And as I was telling you last night, the Benedictines aren't looking for spiritual gold medalists. They just want a God, to believe in a God who is going to work through their lives. Some of you know about Thomas Merton. I mentioned him last night. And if you've ever read The Seven Story Mountain, which is his autobiography that was became a bestseller, I think it was in the 1950s. He entered into the monastic life when he was an adult, having already had some of his adult life. And he said, when the doors closed behind me in the monastery, I became free. Again, I think we think of stability as the lack of freedom. But really, for him, it was the beginning of his freedom. That even connects with St. Augustine. St. Augustine said that one day, when our salvation is complete and we see God face to face, we will be completely free and we will no longer be able to sin. The inability to sin is true freedom. Because as long as we have the ability to sin, we're a walking battleground. That's not free. We're tempted all the time. I have to deal with that all the time. That's not freedom. Freedom is when I rest in the will of God. And when I trust God and no longer are doing that. In fact, stability is my share in Christ's own steadfastness. It's being in Christ, in his fidelity to his Father's will, even to death on a cross. That's not fun in sometimes, right? Dying on a cross is not fun. But Christ did it freely out of his love for the world. And, you know, I've often reflected on, I was preaching to my Fuller class the other night because I was getting irritated about something. And that is the fact that there's some churches, you know, and some proclaimers of the gospel that always give this as the invitation. You want to come to Jesus because your life's going to be great. You're going to be successful and, you know, you'll be prosperous and you'll be happy and all that. And I was telling them, I never read that in the Gospels. Every time Jesus gives an altar call, what is it? Come follow me. You'll probably lose your possessions, maybe your family, and you will. You'll lose your life. Yeah, in the age to come, you'll get 100-fold. But not now. Because why? I'm going to the cross. And if you want to follow me, that's where you're headed to. What if those megachurch guys did that? I'm not coming down to all megachurches. But I mean, that's where I hear it a lot. You know, they don't say, now, I want you to consider coming to Jesus Christ today. And it might mean you have to give up a lot. A lot. And it might even be that your family will turn against you. And by the way, we've been to Sudan a few times. And we have met some people who became Christians whose family turned against them. They became Christians at great risk of their lives. Yeah. Yeah. You might die. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, when Christ bids a person come, he bids that person come and die. So again, where God calls us to be is where we need to accept in the sense. Again, it's not, I want to be heard correctly, not abusive situations, but the day-to-day tasks and the communities that God calls us to, the church community you're in. For some reason, God called you to be here this weekend, but to be part of this community as well and to hang with it. Because something that you are or you say might change people's lives, or something that is done or said in the community might change your life and shape you the way that God wants you to be shaped. That's the amazing thing about this stability. Isn't it really the concept in the New Testament of abiding? Of Jesus saying, abide in me like a vine, branch in the vine. It's dwelling in. Those are the kind of words that are in the Bible. To remain, to abide, to dwell in, to be united to Jesus with this image of branches in a vine. In monastic terms, that's stability of heart. So we don't want to be gyrovags wandering around in circles. But unfortunately, I think that's a lot of what we are in the culture that we live in today. And I think the church is the prime community to be that alternative culture that says, nah, you can be where God wants you to be, and it doesn't require this constant external stimulus, and it doesn't require constant change. Yeah, so I want to open up the Q&A or comments you have.
I was going to say, yeah. I think sometimes a lot of us are new to the Anglican tradition, and oftentimes when people come into this tradition or any kind of liturgical tradition, don't the words that you repeat over and over again,
oh,
don't they get like stale and dead?
Yeah.
I just think it almost connects.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for mentioning that, Ryan. Because one of the things that I... okay, so when I grew up as a Baptist, right, we talked about this the other day. We thought Presbyterians, Lutherans, you know, they wear robes, light candles, read their prayers in church. They're going to hell in a handbasket, you know. We Baptists, you know, we sang a song, you know, maybe you know this song, one door and only one, and yet its sides are two. I'm on the inside, and which side are you? What we really meant was, one door and only one, and yet inside are two. I'm on the inside, and you're going to hell. We even went to this was in the late '60s, and it was the coffee house era, you know, and the hippies and all that. And this, I remember, this Methodist church had a coffee house, you know. Dark and dank, and you know, so the hair would grow. And anyway, so you go in there, and we were going to convert them, you know, because they're Methodists and they have a coffee. Now, true, they were teaching astrology in the sanctuary, so all right, so they were liberal Methodists, but nonetheless, and a lot of it had to do with the fact that a lot of what they were doing in worship was rote, right? It was the same stuff week after week. Catholics, I mean, they weren't even on the chart for us, you know. But I've since learned, and it was becoming a Presbyterian that taught me this, and then moving into the Anglican Church, that habits are actually good for us because they cultivate us, right? In other words, I remember years ago, going to the dentist, although they changed the rule on this now, so that messed with my head, but this dentist told me, this is why you should floss every night. She gave me, you know, she said, just for your health, bacteria can enter into your gums, yada, yada, yada. So I started flossing every night. And now it's a habit, right? I brush my teeth in the morning, I brush my teeth at night, I floss. I don't make a to-do list. I don't say, okay, today, let's see, I've got to eat, and oh, I've got to floss. it's become a habit to sustain my physical health. And I thought, habits and even liturgy are for the same reason, to sustain my spiritual health, right? And so, and even when I, so every morning, for instance, when I either, if we go to the gym, we go to the gym first and I come back and the first thing I do is, I get my cup of coffee, but I sit down and I open my prayer book that I use. The Church of England Daily Prayer book is wonderful. And the Psalms and scripture reading. If we don't go to the gym, then the first thing I do is get my coffee and go to my prayer book. That's become a habit. And sometimes I'm not even as attentive as I should be to some of the words that I'm reading every day, you know. But I know that they're getting in me. And that's what I was talking about, you know, living from excitement. I got to feed, and the habits are actually cultivating me to be the kind of person I should be, and keeping me spiritually healthy. Habits shape our character. They shape who we are. We become our habits. And that's why I think in the liturgy, by saying the same things over and over again, even if we're not as attentive as we should be, or they're not meaning the same thing, I think they're still getting in our being. And that's I think that's what you're talking about. And it's, you know, the kind of things we do over and over again will come back to us. I was saying to you last night that, you know, sometimes when I'm almost half awake in the morning, my head is already saying, open my lips, O Lord, and my mouth shall declare your praise. What a great way to start the day. Mm-hmm. With the first words in your mind, open my lips, O Lord, and my mouth shall declare your praise. And the reason that it's in my head is because that's in my prayer book every morning. Those are the first words every morning in my prayer book. Yeah. So isn't that a great way to start the day? Open my lips, O Lord, and my mouth shall declare your praise. And it just starts the day that way. Yeah. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later today, too, about balance in life and the rhythm of life when we get together after the afternoon, and that factors into it, too. Do you want to say more about that, too, or...
No, I just think it's like a, even for me personally, I think I've struggled sometimes because while I want stability to bring life to me, sometimes I feel dead.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then it's all of a sudden the new thing that hits me that I'm like, ooh, that's exciting, and I wake up again. But I also notice that there is a deeper, longer work that's happening in me by staying with the words, the stable words, you know, and... And I think maybe it's the connection to the conversatio more that you're going to talk about, that where there's life in that, there's stability here, and there's change here, or something like that.
Well, yeah, that's right. Let me say this. I don't mean to be heard to say that you know, we shouldn't encounter new things at all.
Right.
Not at all. It's just that when we're looking for the new things because we're so dissatisfied with what is, mm-hmm. that we think the grass is going to be greener if we move over there. The new things can, of course, contribute to that. And but it adds to what has already been developed in our lives, right? It adds to it. I mean, even the monks appreciate guests in the monastery because they bring some freshness to their lives. Yeah, and they appreciate that. But it's the freshness brought into the daily rhythm of their lives that cannot be interrupted. Again, we'll talk more about balance and the rhythm of life later today. But that's they will not allow that to be interrupted. But yeah, the new stuff coming in is helpful in that sense. Yeah. So I think we need that. So, Dave.
Yeah, actually, on that thought, so when we were carpooling, we were actually talking about this topic, and I was saying how, actually, when you're reading literature, we're thinking about liturgy, the very discovery that, oh, it doesn't resonate with me, I wonder why, there's maybe something behind that, like, am I reading something about homeless or having a heart for others, but I don't feel them, I don't feel the presence.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that, honestly,
yeah.
It's kind of like almost like a self-feedback.
Just
like when we're learning new skills, especially like physical skills, the first step you have to learn gross physical skills, the large movements. So, but as you go along your path to mastery, you start to fine-tune, you start to get micro-adjustments.
Yep. Yep.
It's just like maybe preachers even, sermons, at first they give, it's a huge message, it's a huge blocks of thoughts, but then the really good ones, they can just focus on the phrase, one word, and it changes everything.
Yeah.
So likewise, as we get into liturgy more and more, as we seep into it, I think we'll notice some more subtleties, more nuances, that if we stick with it, otherwise we won't have that blessing.
Yeah, that's right. You know, Dallas Willard, his first major book, The Spirit of the Disciplines, he talks about, he compares these habits that we have, and he's not necessarily talking about liturgy, but I think liturgy is part of that. Saying it's like learning to play Major League Baseball. You practice drills over and over and over again, so that when the situation comes up, you don't have time to think about what to do. You just do it automatically, right? And he's saying the same thing in the spiritual life. We practice over and over and over again. So that when the situation does come up, when you do see a homeless person or something, you're not thinking, oh, how despicable. You're thinking, oh, that's a person made in the image of God for whom Jesus Christ died, right? And that's become ingrained in you, even by the liturgy itself.
I would think psychologically it's kind of self-conditioning.
Yeah, self-conditioning, sure. Yeah. I mean, if you want to put it in that kind of way. I mean, of course, enabled by God's grace.
Right.
But in fact, you're making me think, too, of a... like many of you, I was reared, of course, believing that it's all of God's grace, and there's nothing I can do to win God's approval and so forth. And I do believe that. There's nothing you can do, as Philip Yancey said, to make God love you more, but there's nothing you can do to make God love you less either. But then that sometimes leads, especially evangelical Christians, to be so focused on grace that we forget that our faith has to be seen in our works, right? So there was a, John Cassian was a church father who really is behind a lot of what Benedict is writing, C-A-S-S-I-A-N, John Cassian. And he's from a more of an Eastern Orthodox Christian perspective, and he puts out this question. He says, what's required for a farmer's crops to grow? The farmer's toil or good weather? It's a trick question. Both. Yeah, and he's saying it's simultaneous. The farmer's crop could not grow without good weather. Our lives could not grow spiritually without God's grace. But they won't grow either if the farmer just says, all right, good weather, let's just let it grow. So we have to be attentive and very proactive about that. And some of it has to do with, constantly coming to the liturgy and a daily practice, too. Again, we're going to talk more about that later today, but a daily practice of, I mean, stability is also for the monks about going to the daily office. For some monasteries, four times a day; for others, eight times a day, And
do you want to clarify what daily office is?
Yeah, sure.
Do that so that you're going to the work.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, Benedict calls it Opus Dei. The daily office is for him the work of God. It's the most important thing the monk does. And so what monks do when they go to daily office, like we've had this morning, originally, again, there were 8 offices. I told you this last night. Benedict gets it from Psalm 119, 7+1. And so they would get up. The first office would be vigil, and it would be in the middle of the night. And they would get up, and that's a pretty long prayer service. The vigil is one of the longer ones. And they would chant psalms. They would hear scripture read. So just like we did today, psalms and scripture read. They might hear a little meditation on the scripture, but not necessarily. It's mostly just psalms and scripture, and then prayers. Prayers for the world or prayers for themselves and so forth. That was the central aspect of the daily office. So vigils was first, and then lauds, which means praise, would be morning praise. By the way, lauds and then later vespers, evening prayer, those came out of the Jewish context because the Jewish context always did morning prayer and evening prayer. And then sometimes they had 3 o'clock afternoon prayer in the Jewish context. So we went from vigils to lauds, and then you had the 4 little hours of the day, starting at 6. So you had, prime, sex, known, terse, yeah, I got the order right? Prime, terse, sex, and known, yeah. Known was the 9th hour of the day. And then you had vespers, and then you had compline, which means completion of the day. And then you entered into the great silence for night, and then started all over again. And as I said, a lot of Benedictines today have taken the 4 little hours and combined them into 1. So they'll have, like when I go to St. Andrew's Abbey in Valyermo on a private retreat where I rent you can go to a monastery and rent a room. And they give you meals and a room, and you can set your own agenda, or you can join the monks in prayer. I join them only because I need the rhythm of the day. I've done a private retreat where I've just kind of structured myself. It doesn't work for me. You know, it just doesn't work for me. I need the community where the bell rings and it says, okay, Akon, put down the pencil if you're writing, put down the book if you're reading, or if you're walking around, get ye to the church, right? You got 5 minutes. So you go, and so at St. Andrew's, vigils is at 5:30 in the morning, and then you go back to your room, and I think it's at 8 o'clock is lauds, then they have breakfast, and then the monks work, assigned tasks, then they have mass at noon time, and then they have lunch, then they go back to work again, and then they come for vespers, which is evening prayer, about 5 o'clock, then they have dinner. And then they have a little bit of time for reflection and rest, and then come back for compline, which would be about 8:30. And that would last about a half an hour. And then they go into the great silence, where you're supposed to be silent and retire. And then the great silence ends with, open my lips, O Lord, and my mouth shall declare your praise. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the rhythm of the day, and that's the daily office that Benedict set up, and many monastic communities follow in one way or another. Yeah, and that rhythm of the day, well, again, we'll talk more about it later too, really helps to establish balance in our lives. Yeah.
Good question. What does Vespers mean?
Well, it's just evening prayer. I don't know where the word came from. I don't know.
Like Vesper light, it means something like dusk.
But it just means evening prayer,
Right. Yeah, I'm just kind of making a comment about the liturgy and doing it on a regular rhythm every Sunday when we have the liturgy, follow the liturgy. It centers me again. It reminds me who I am, why I exist. And I need to come back to that sense of centering. And if it was a different speaker, a different music, and everything just exciting every week, I would not be able to be centered back in who I am and by reciting the prayers and the creeds. And the sacraments remind me of who I am and who I belong. I love that rhythm for the liturgy. It's been so meaningful in my life.
Yeah. And to add to that, it brings the tradition of doing that. It brings comfort.
That's true.
It does.
That's true.
It rehearses it over and over. we would not have that sense of comfort.
Right.
Yeah.
And presence. And wherever I go, and I go into an Anglican church, and I have
that's true, too.
And
the liturgy is the
I
same.
I belong here. Yeah.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah.
It's being fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, even with your strangers, the liturgy is the same. Yeah.
I once heard that was very interesting about the more the daily office and the liturgy, because the text is more or less kind of fixed.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I mean, when we come, language is contextual.
Yes, it is.
But also, we, the reader or the chanter or the participant, is contextual too. So we bring our lives to
yep.
the text.
Yeah.
And so when we all lend ourselves to a single text, amazing how much you see the contours over time, and actually if you're having a static interaction with the text, it might mean that there's static in your life, like
that's
you're not
true.
Growing,
yeah.
and you're not, God's not kind of, you're not learning or flowing like in different ways, and so sometimes you'll read the same prayer, but God will be kind of teaching you something where it just kind of jumps off the page.
Yeah.
You know, and there's times of dryness, but.
Yeah, there are, and we have to accept that too.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? Yeah, we do.
Yeah, so. Yeah, it was an interesting thing that a friend shared with me, is that embrace the dryness, but also use it to reflect, like, oh, you know, like, what am I bringing to the text? What is God teaching me? And if
yeah.
it keeps kind of dry, you think, well,
yeah.
maybe there's some place
that's fine. And what you're saying, though, I think it's important to point out that part of the stability and the hupomone, the perseverance, is even continuing, even when it's the dry times, right? One time, I was giving a ride to a monk from a conference that we were at in Indiana back home to the Chicago area. So we had about a 3-hour drive together. And along the way, because I was always asking monks, both men and women, monastics, they prefer to use the word monastic because that's not gender, yeah, that's gender inclusive. So I always would ask the men and women, which of the two bestsellers of Kathleen Norris they liked better, Dakota or Cloister Walk? Because I personally like Dakota better. And that's about the similarity between living in South Dakota in her grandmother's home and the monastery. It's kind of cool. It's a beautiful, poetic book. So I asked him, you know, which one do you like? And I forget what his answer was, but what he went on to say was, and I'm quoting him, he said, and the problem with Kathleen, though, is that she makes our life look so interesting, and it's so damn tedious. So I love the honesty. Yeah, Lucy?
I'm just kind of curious, as you're talking, I can't help but think about what an anxious age we seem to live in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And getting more anxious, don't you think?
And getting
yeah.
more anxious, yeah, I'd say. And I'm wondering, you know, as you talk about stability and even... like you just alluded to, like maybe it's not a bad thing if you're bored, you know, or like
yeah.
choices. I mean,
yeah.
how do you see that connection?
Yeah. I think it has a lot to do with, you know, all the media that has many good features about it. Let's not deny that, right?
So
our connect, yeah, everything, cell phones and all that, and the statistic about cell phones of 5 hours a day—that's a lot, you know, of your waking hours. But it's all coming from outside. So I just have to find ways to settle. And by the way, there was a monastic female. She's translating a French guy, Albert de Vogue, who is a great Benedictine scholar. She's translating all his stuff on the Benedictine rule. But she gave a talk on contemporary techno life and spirituality. And I was going to mention this later today, but I'll mention it now. So I think I have to find ways that, I don't know if counteract is the right way to put it, but ways to say, okay, I need this media, but I also need to remember God is present. A couple of things I do is I bought a postcard at a monastery that quotes, I think it's Emily Dickinson, says, God is here. That's all it says. Okay, I forgot that, yeah. And then there's an app called ProdMe that she put me onto, this monastic. You can download this app for free, and it's a timer. And you can set the timer. And so I have it set at 15 minutes. And every 15 minutes it goes, ding, when I'm on my computer. And if I'm working, I remember, oh, yeah, God. Because otherwise, I forget, right? I mean, I need that. So now I'm using the technology, actually, to remind me. It's kind of funny when we hooked it up to our TV and watched a movie, the computer to the TV, and you're watching a movie and all of a sudden something happens and it goes, ding! Yeah, and it comes at a good time in the movie. I don't know if that really addresses what you were saying, though. Come back to me if I'm...
I think I was thinking just more about, it seems like in general, like we're becoming more and more anxious in society. Probably the election coming up isn't helping. I guess, as you talk about stability, even just keeping your externals the same, keep your people the same versus constantly looking for the next opportunity, you're making the next choice, or even people tend to stay in jobs for 1.5 years now versus a 40-year career. There's so much shift, so much change.
So much shifting that, yeah.
If you see a connection there.
Yeah, I do. I do think there's a connection there. And by the way, I'll be the first one to admit, and Trevecca will tell you, I'm a news junkie and I love politics, and so I'm always watching that. So I confess to that. However, there are times when I just have to say, okay, I got to stop. I can't look at that anymore because I have to attend to what God has called me to do now, teach or prepare a lecture or write or whatever. So I guess what I was saying though in answer to your question is, to deal with it, I think we need to find ourselves. Each of us have to find ourselves some practices. To deal with that. I mean, even the prodmi. I mean, if you were reminded constantly that, God is in control. And I have to remind myself that, that there's a Stanley Hauerwas prayer that I prayed to my class with my class the other day. And, it starts out, here we're at it again, God, thinking that we can control our own destiny by voting. And I need to have ways to remind me in the anxiety that... And I think that would apply to some people who maybe are having a hard time at a job or something like that. There are frustrations and they have to be dealt with. But I think it does get back to this idea, I've got to have faith in God's providence. One of the things I do intentionally, and because I do think, talking about the anxiety... this essay that I read when I was coming out about this man who went to a meditation conference or whatever, what do you call it? Then they had to put their cell phones in a basket at the beginning of the 3 or 4 days. And he said when he did that, the anxiety just went skyrocketing because he was losing his cell phone. And I know some of you know that you've read scientific studies of neurophysiology that they've done on the brain. That it's an addiction, it's become an addiction. I know my students, many of them are addicted to the cell phone. If they were to lose it, they would have withdrawal symptoms, the equivalent of withdrawal symptoms. So one of the things that I've done, and I know not everybody can do this because like a doctor couldn't do this, certain pastor cannot do this, but I choose to leave my cell phone in the car unless I'm traveling. If I'm traveling, I take it with me because then I can, phone people. But I leave it in the car. I don't take it with me. I leave it in the car because if I get into an accident or something, it's there, for an emergency, or if I need directions. But
we can't leave things in our cars.
No, I understand that. I totally understand it. I totally understand. So leave it home. But that won't help you if you get an accident or have the reason I do it is because of what I've seen of other people and my students and everything. I don't want to be that. And I know it would, constantly checking, who I need to check on somebody or something. There's a wonderful description that Cashin gives in his conferences about the sin of akedia, which is a weariness of the soul and not paying attention to God. And he says, if the monk who is guilty of this, okay, akedia became connected to another sin, tristitia, and these two thoughts blended together in Gregory the Great's thought in the 6th century when he put the list of 7 deadly sins and renamed it sloth. So we think of sloth as laziness, but they were describing sloth as also busyness. Sloth, right? You're not attending to your awareness of God in relationship with God. So he describes the monk who's guilty of akedia as going from cell to cell, checking on them. Oh, I've got to check on this this monk, I mean, he was sick the other day. I got to check on him. Oh, I know he might need my help over here. And he might, oh, I got to go over here. And he needs to go to his cell and stay in his cell because he needs to center down. And he's too, and his busyness. They've done statistics of pastors on how much time they spend in prayer in a week themselves. And a huge number do not spend a significant amount of time in prayer during the week because they're so task-oriented. And so that's just one way that I mean, that's anxiety. That's anxiousness, you know, to always be checking up and making sure. And, oh, you know, and so I just choose, that's one of my lifestyle choices. I just leave in the car. But I guess in Costa Mesa I can do that. So, Kyle had a comment first.
I just would like to hear you speak into stability with the Psalter.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Use your own spiritual habits.
Yeah.
Surrounding the
sure. Yeah, and that'll get into balance a little bit later on today.
Okay, if that's coming up later, then that's fine.
Yeah, I'll talk about it more later. Okay. But I just to know that the Psalter is non-negotiable for me every day. Mm-hmm. I must go to the Psalter.
Yeah.
And I'll say more about it.
People who don't know the Psalter is
it's the Psalms. It's the Psalms. Yeah.
Salt shaker.
By the way, I did a. That's good. I did a. So I don't know, Elizabeth. Does that resonate a little bit with what you're saying?
A little bit. Technology with technology is like the anti-stability because it's always taking us out of ourselves.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Or it makes me think I'm in control, as somebody pointed out in an essay. Having the world in my hand, I'm in control now.
Yeah,
I don't want to have that attitude either, you know, because I'm not.
Well, and you're always exposed to the world, right?
Yeah, I'm always exposed to it, too.
So
yourself. Yeah.
So there's no stability there.
Yeah, exactly.
Mind, so, yeah.
You want to pick up on that, right?
I was an anecdote to say that this restless acedia, as you said, I notice in myself when I have tasks and I'm sitting in front of my computer, I have this severe temptation to do a round on the news.
Like, yeah. Oh, I do too.
Refresh
I do
the
too.
News,
yeah.
On,
yeah.
Or go to that's when I go to Facebook and say, "Oh, what's happening?"
Yeah.
And that is exactly when I'm doing sloth, actually. It's
yes.
Like I'm avoiding being present with what I need to be present with.
Yeah.
And so I distract myself.
I have the same temptation on the news, not on Facebook, because I'm not on Facebook.
Every Lent, I fast from news for that reason.
That's good.
Break that habit.
Yeah.
That's where I want to go.
Yeah.
And it seems harmless. So I'm just learning about the world, you know.
That's right. And by the way, talking about Lent, one of the monks helped me understand about Lent, that Lent is a time that you do some spiritual analysis and find out where your spiritual flab is, like you would for a gym. And when you go to the gym, if you've got a certain part of your body you want to focus on, then you do an exercise that focuses on that. And so he said, and that's kind of what you're doing. You find out what the spiritual flab is, and then you practice a discipline that will attack that flab. Yeah, that part of the spiritual flab. So that's exactly what you were trying to do. What's that? Yeah. Just work on one a year. Just work on one. That's helpful rather than just giving up chocolate, you know, or something like that. I mean, it's more direct. So that when you come out of Lent, it's a joyful experience. Because Lent is supposed to be a joyful denial. So, by the way, Sundays are not part of Lent. Did you know that?
Yes.
Right. So that an Anglican priest up near Bass Lake, that a little church would go to, he said to his congregation, "So at 11:59 on Saturday night, I pour my scotch."
Thank you so much for tuning in to the second part of our four-part series, Urban Contemplative. Stay tuned for part 3.